Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Metaphysical Hour. This is Julia Cannon, and today is February 10th of 2017. I had to think about that. I always do. Let's see. What's going on? I have no idea what's going on in the world. It's not because I have my head in the sand. It's just because I choose not to be part of that's not my reality out there. So I don't watch the news. I don't take part in it. So I don't know. But I do know there's a gorgeous moon out there tonight, and that's my reality. So for some reason, I needed to say that. Anyway, we have our UFO conference coming up in, in April, April 14th to the 16th, and sorry, our 30th, the 30th annual UFO conference. This is the longest running, continuously running UFO conference, I think, in the world. Our guest probably knows a whole lot about that as far as maybe statistics and stuff on that. We'll see. He's got so much information in him. I am always astounded. and one of the largest UFO conferences in the U.S. It just always amazes me. I was at the very first conference when it first started with Lou Farish, and then I was there off and on throughout the years. And this has got such a story. This conference has been such longstanding. And then that's how we're going to kick it off as our guest tonight. Special guest is, has been the MC with many, many of the conferences. And so a lot of, the conference this year is we were bringing back many of the speakers that we've had over the years. And so there'll be a lot of reminiscing of the past 30 years. And that's what we want to do tonight. I wanted to kick it off with the MC that we've had for many of the years, as well as we will have him again this year. So I want to welcome our wonderful, wonderful MC extraordinaire, Forrest Crawford. Welcome, Forrest.
Oh, thank you very much for all the kind words.
Oh, you're very welcome. You are fantastic. My gosh, you were so highly. We made a mistake of not having you the very first year that we took the conference over, and that was just because we were, we had our other conference that we did, and we were just used to doing our thing our way, and that was with Mom doing the emceeing, and then people were like, "Where's Forrest? Where's Forrest?" And we're like, "Well, we'll get Forrest." and it was like, oh my gosh. And then we got you, and it's like, I see why you're in demand. But you are fantastic. Oh, my goodness.
Well, thank you. Public speaking is not one of my phobias, in case you didn't know that. you guys put wonderful conferences, and Dolores was a fantastic, MC for everything you guys are doing. So, it certainly wasn't a bad thing. And I had to bribe like 500 people to get them to, recommend me to come back. I'm teasing about that.
Okay, so you lost some money that year, huh?
Yeah. No, I'm just, I'm very honored to be able to come back and do it. Lou was a friend of mine for many, many years, and I think the conference is the best UFO conference in the world. And it's just the location is very, very special, and it's always just been a fantastic experience. I have never come down there and not had some kind of strange thing, spiritual awakening, new experience happened to me, and a lot of people feel the same way about the conference.
I was going to have you talk about that. I was going to, because I know every year that I've been there with you, you've had a sighting or something happen, and so I was wanting you to talk about that.
Oh, I can, and I honestly, it's one of those, I don't even know where to start, so we'll just start someplace.
I know.
I've been accused by my lifelong UFO buddies of like withholding information, because I'll tell a story that they've known me for like 20 years and they've never heard before, and it's like, I'm not holding out on you. I just don't remember all, you know, whether I told you these stories or not. So, like I said, I don't even know exactly where to start. But I think the first conference that I attended was either 89 or 90. And then the year after that, I started as a speaker at the conferences and spoke at every one of them up through the early 2000s, I guess. And then I kind of did, you know, speaking sporadically. And then Lou would have me come down and do, you know, the emceeing or to basically kind of run management over the panel discussions that he used to have. So I've only missed, out of the 30, I think I've only missed maybe 4 or 5.
Wow.
And everyone has been a strange experience, wonderful experience. I mean, literally, I'll give you one example of how you never know what's going to happen at the conference. And, you know, I'm walking through the parking lot at the end of the day, like I think it was Friday night, and a bunch of people are walking by, and they grab me and they go, "Oh, Forrest, come with us. I got something to show you. You know, I'm going to show these folks something really cool." And so I followed this group of 6 or 8 people back to this guy's room, and the guy happened to be Lloyd Pye. So, you know, I don't know who Lloyd Pye is, but this was the Star Child Skull guy, okay? God rest his soul. And this was before anybody really knew who he was. He wasn't on the speaking circuit at all. And within 5 minutes, I'm in his room, and I'm holding in my hand the Star Child Skull, looking at, you know, doing the last Yorick, you know, looking into the eyes. And you know, now that's all just fantastic UFO history of all that has happened with that being literally being a potential alien artifact. But that's the kind of thing. You're just, I'm strolling through the parking lot, next thing you know, alien skull in my hand. You know what I mean? That's the kind of thing that happens.
So. When you were telling that, my whole body just started buzzing.
It's hilarious. I think back about it, you know. One of the things about these conferences, and I think this is true of every last one of them, because I have spoken all over the country for a while, and really the only reason I quit is I don't really have anything new to talk about. Like, I'm not doing a lot of new research, and I refuse to speak just to hear myself talk. You know what I mean? When I got something new to talk about, maybe I'll jump back into the arena. But I think all of the UFO conferences, that the really, really intense stuff happens in somebody's room after the conference is over for that day. And like,
so the conference after the conference.
It's like the conference kind of brings it all together, and the information that is given is kind of for everybody, I guess. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
From a researcher's standpoint, we don't always get to visit with each other. And so when we come to a conference, it's usually like an old friend's reunion, because we don't necessarily, you know, get to visit that often. So you get these little groups of researchers going back to their room and then talking about, like, the really intense stuff. In some cases, the things that you're not really ready to talk about at the podium yet, or stuff that you're not sure about and you're trying to piece together. And so if any of the speakers ever says, "Hey, come back to my room, we're going to talk," go with them.
They mean it.
Do not do that. You can sleep later when you're dead. You know, go back to the room, stay up all night, and the most extraordinary things will happen to you.
Good advice. Good advice. Very cool. So you have seen, like you said, I mean, I was just amazed at all of the people and all of the, you know, that you've seen over the years and you've met over the years that you know, and all the information that you have. That's what makes you such a wonderful MC, because you have personal experiences with everybody.
Pretty much. I've got some dirt on people. not really, but you kind of get to learn each other's secrets because you've shared experiences, and I love to talk about that whenever I'm bringing a speaker up to the podium. It just, mm-hmm. Kind of puts it all home and makes it much more personal, I think.
Right, yeah. Now, the ones that we have coming up this year, have you worked, I'm sure you have, because many of them are people that we've had before. We can go ahead and talk about some of them.
I just got the flyer today, by the way, in the mail. So
fantastic.
I'm actually very excited about the speakers list. The only person on here that I don't think that I've ever met, but I'm not sure, is Mike Cleland. Everybody else on here I and or know very well.
Super.
I'm looking for this to be a nice family reunion kind of a thing. So I'm very mm-hmm. excited about the lineup.
Okay. Go ahead. I know we're kind of talking over each other a little bit and apologize for that. We're having to kind of makeshift here. We have a different system tonight. Go ahead and say what you were going to say.
Okay. Like Stan, for instance, if he's ever spoke at this conference, it was in either the first one or the second one. Because he hasn't spoke all the whole time that I've been down at the conference. So it'll be exciting.
Yeah, I don't think he has. I don't think he has spoken here, and that's why we were excited to get him.
Right. And so that's kind of, and I actually haven't seen Stanton in a number of years since he was in Missouri for some of the conferences that were being held there back in the 90s. So it's been a long time since I've seen him. So that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very excited. Travis is coming back. David is a good friend of mine. Debbie is a good mm-hmm. friend of mine. I can't wait to hear Grant talking about the art stuff and the music, because I've actually done a lot of research myself on that, and I'm really interested to see what he's going to...
Cool. Let's go ahead and talk about these a little bit. We have time here, so we can go ahead and open them up a little bit about what they're going to talk about. Well, let's see, because I have the list here. On the first day, like James Clarkson,
ufologist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you worked with him before or seen him?
Some. I've met him a couple of times. I know of him. I think he actually knows of him, and I probably have a mutual friend from the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
I used to actually go up there with some frequency. And I did a couple of speeches and radio interviews while I was up there for Poo Fog was the name of the group that was up there. I don't think they're still in existence. And so I'm very interested to kind of reconnect with him and catch up a bit. Like the Childresses live up there, I believe, in Washington State. And had a strange experience with them years ago when I was up there, too. This is one of the other things. That I thought about, like, what are we going to talk about tonight? And one of the things that I thought was, this journey, okay, as a researcher.
Actually, that's what I usually do, is, like, how you got here on this, to this road. What even brought you here to this whole thing? How, that's how I start. And we just got off on this other track. But how I like to start my shows is, whatever got you into this world
So this is about a six-hour radio show. I think it'll take about that long.
Yeah, exactly.
I can summarize. What got me started was simply whenever I was 10 years old, I was above Pierre Marquette State Park in Illinois. At an all-day picnic with my best friend and his parents, his aunts and uncles. This was sort of like kid having, barbecue, hot dogs, BB gun shooting, swimming in the river, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And So this was around 1968. I think I just tipped my hat how old I really am. And then we were on the way back home that night, I'm guessing about midnight in the summer. And as we were driving back, I mean, the drive back from there to the Illinois town near St. Louis that we lived was probably about an hour. We were seeing this unusual, like, yellowish, whitish glow that was off of the road. We couldn't see what was making the glow, but we could see this glow. And it was pretty odd. And it would move around, like, behind a tree line on the other side of a little levee. And then it would move away, and we wouldn't see it for a few minutes, and then we'd see it again. And it was weird enough that, like, we're trying to guess what it was. And so my friend's dad said, like, no, it's probably like a pickup truck with the yellow driving lights driving around over there, you know. There's a lot of roads by the river, you know, that kind of thing. But even at 10 years old, I'm like, no, that ain't it, you know. So at one point, we kind of round the bend, and this thing was, whatever it was in this field behind this tree line right next to the road, and it wasn't moving. So he was curious enough, pulled the car over, and, you know, being the courageous man that he was, he said, get out and see what that is. Yeah, myself, my friend John, and his mom, we were in the back seat of the car kind of goofing around on the way home, and his dad was driving. So I was the first out of the passenger side door, stood on the door handle, which made me tall enough to see over this little, like, roadside levee, and I could see into the field. And what I saw, approximately 150 feet away, approximately 35 or 40 feet in diameter, was... for lack of a better term, a flying saucer. Plain as day.
Oh, my gosh.
I could tell that it was metallic, but the whole thing glowed this kind of pale yellowish color. And there were, the best way to describe what it looked like is if you imagine the Pizza Hut logo, okay, it looked like the Pizza Hut logo, kind of. The upright part was a little bit more upright, and there were rectangular windows, I guess, around that upper part of the craft, and that was a short, stout, like thick antenna with a ball on it right in the center of this thing. It was hovering about 15 feet off of the ground, and the light underneath it was so bright you couldn't even see the grass. It was like just brilliant bright underneath the craft. It was making this really cool UFO noise, you know, like wood, you know. And while I watched it, three landing gear was scoped out of the bottom of this thing, and it set down on the ground, and the light dimmed, and the sound went down, and this all happened within the first 30 seconds or so. And so my friend and his mom were coming out behind me. They didn't get completely out of the car, but so they didn't actually see the landing gear, but they saw the craft, the top part of the craft. And so his dad is like, well, what is it? And I go, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. So he's getting out of the car, he stands on the bottom and makes him tall enough to see it, and he flips out, absolutely just flips out. To this day, I've never seen an adult more afraid in my whole life. He's screaming for us to get back to the car. And when I tell this story, this is where I say that the alien technology caused the Nash Rambler to exceed its design capabilities. In other words, he floored it. So we're doing like 80, 90 miles an hour on these curvy country roads to get the heck out of there. And I remember thinking, like, oh, that's cool. And I wasn't afraid at all. I wanted to get out of the car and sit up and see what happened. And he had, you know, other plans. It scared him so bad it wasn't even funny. To his dying day, he never allowed any of us to speak about it aloud. If we brought it up, he would get violently angry and yell at us and would not let us talk about it.
Wow, you really shook his foundation, didn't you?
Yeah.
Or it did.
Yeah, well.
Wow.
That's what got me stuck. Because even at 10, the way I put it is that I wasn't afforded the luxury of skepticism. At 10 years old, you know, I knew enough about stuff to not be stupid, but I certainly, you know, wasn't a scientist. But I knew that what I was looking at was not man-made. You know, it was not explained. And it piqued my scientific curiosity. And by age 13, I started collecting UFO books. By the time I was 18, I had 250 books in my library on UFOs and paranormal stuff. That went up to around 500 books before my basement leaked and ruined a bunch of them. But I was hooked after that. So, the other part of this experience is when you talk about, okay, well, that would obviously get somebody excited about this topic, perhaps. But what makes you crazy enough to want to get involved in investigations, to want to, like, write and speak about what you talk, you know, about what you research, and to basically be in it for a lifetime? That explanation gets a little more involved. And I think that all researchers kind of go through this, where for many, many years, I would have told you that I'm on a quest for the truth and I want to disseminate the truth and the information I learned to other people, because they have the right to the truth. You know, mm-hmm. So we have this kind of purpose, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you, for me, and I think for many, many researchers, there's also something else going on. Us that choose to speak out about it, that's kind of part of what we are. We need to do that. But we're also very much on a personal journey to understand our relationship to this phenomenon. And it gets really bizarre when you step out of that, hey, I measured the burn spot, you know, we went into the lab and we tested the dust on the cow, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. When you get into trying to understand, why am I doing this? Why am I involved? Why did I see that craft in the first place?
Yeah.
Why do all these other weird things seem to happen? Because I can tell you, we could talk for weeks about the weird synchronicities that have happened to me, and I know this is true of many, many, many other researchers as well. The strange things that happen that add meaning to this thing that's not there even on the surface of how strange it is. That's one of the reasons I'm excited about Grant's presentation also, is because I've had this very odd connection with the Moody Blues ever since I was a child, with them music, and then later to some extent in a very indirect way with the actual band members and some people that are in UFO research. But you could actually do like a whole show just on the Moody Blues and their connection to the UFO phenomena. But I have in relation to their music literally ever since I was a kid. And just to give you an example of how strange this is.
Okay.
So I'm standing on the door of the car and I'm looking at this flying saucer land in this field, right?
Mm-hmm.
I, for whatever reason, and I was pretty confident that I knew where this spot was, but for whatever reason, I did not return to that spot for 35 years.
Oh,
okay?
Wow. Uh-huh.
Now, my wife is open-minded, but also very healthy skeptic. So she's good. She keeps me honest, keeps me in check. And she heard my crazy stories, all of them. So we happened to be going up to a town called Hardin, Illinois. It's right by where this happened, for an event up there. And when I looked it up, I go, I think this is going to drive right by where I had my sighting whenever I was 10 years old. And so I was like, okay, well, after we go to the event, well, we'll look around. We'll see if we can find it. So we drove up there, and the first unusual thing is when my vantage point to the landing would be when we were coming home, not when we were going up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when we drove past the spot going up there, I had a very profound physical reaction to driving. I wasn't even looking at to the left where the field was, but I mean, all the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I just had this very, very profound physical reaction, and I'm like, oh, my God, this must be a spot. So we went on, we did our thing, and then on the way back, we come by that part of that field. I'm getting this this strange reaction again, and I'm looking at the scenery, and I'm going, no, this is exactly it. It's exactly as I remembered it 35 years ago.
Wow.
So we stopped the car. There's the little berm next to the field, which is really kind of unusual, but if you saw the area, you'd understand why it was there. And I said, so we got out of the car. There's like a little ditch, and then you go up on this little levee. We're standing on top of it, and we're looking into this field, and there was no crop in the field at the time. I think it was early spring, so the field was left tilled from the season before.
Mm-hmm.
And right smack in the middle of this field was a roughly circular area about 40 feet in diameter that had been untilled for a very, very long time. Like, there was not full-size trees in there, but it was like a deep scrub. And she looked at me, and she looked at that spot, and she's like, because I'm looking at it, I'm going, that's where it landed. Because now I'm in this, like, totally reliving the experience in my head. You know, it was the exact spot. She goes, that's odd. Why would they not plow that spot right in the middle of that field?
Yeah.
And so I said, well, a lot of times when these things land, they change the chemical composition of the soil rather significantly. The soil gets baked hard as a rock. It doesn't accept water anymore. And a lot of farmers won't plow these landing sites because they break the plow blades. Some of them will plow them, and then over 15 or 20 years, finally vegetation starts growing back in them. But I've even seen like a 9-year-old landing site that you could clearly see in a field that had been plowed for all those years, and it was still very visible. So I said, that's my theory, that they just plowed around it because they didn't want to mess up the plow blades. So we had to walk out into the field to make sure it wasn't like an old house foundation or a big tree stump or something, you know. There was nothing out there. It was just no stones. It was just grass and small trees that had been left to grow for a long time. So I'm like, okay, I found the spot again. That's pretty wild. So on the way back, 15 or 20 minutes later, we're looking for a spot along the river road up there to have lunch. So we just she's like, I'm hungry, just find a spot. And so we turn into this like truck stop that had a restaurant built in it, not a place that we would normally stop to eat. And I turned in there, and we go into the restaurant, and they walk us in, they sit us down in a seat, and they're playing radio or music, you know, in the restaurant. And the moment we walked in, the next five songs that played were five Moody Blues songs.
Okay.
And not only that, but the lyrics of the songs, the ones that were picked, were very poignant to this whole situation. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, for one, when have you ever heard five Moody Blues songs in a row on the radio in the last 30 years, you know? And,
yeah,
and two,
exactly.
For the bizarre random location, it was, you know, it was almost like the universe is going, yes, thank you. You finally came back up here, you little moron, and you looked at the landing site, you know.
Yeah, no, you get the message.
Exactly. But that's an example of, like, it's a musical synchronicity for me. And so, like, I'm hoping Grant talks about the Moody Blues. Because, by the way, they've all had lifelong experiences. And they write about it in their lyrics if you know what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
They put clues on their album covers as well. And so there's a whole, this whole mystical, you know, thing going on in the background. And so what I've realized over the years is not only was it a journey with a mission, so to speak, to disseminate the word, but I was also really very much on a mission to understand who I am, I guess, and why I'm involved with this stuff.
Right.
You know, what,
yeah.
So I feel like I'm rambling.
No, keep going. This is wonderful. Okay, so that's what we're looking for. It's like, your whole journey and everything, and then how it relates to, I mean, all of that's relevant to what you're doing and why we have you and all of the information that you have to part to here. Okay, so Grant and the music, that's fantastic, that story. So, okay, well, let's continue with your journey. That's how it all started.
And so did you just, then that just, that started the research and everything, and then it just continued from there?
Well, kind of. What happened is, whenever I was 13, I went in St. Louis. There was, at the time, I think it might have been the largest, like, civilian UFO meeting. It was called the UFO Study Group of Greater St. Louis. God love them, they still exist. And they, like, Walt Andrus regularly showed up. The Lorenzans, the guy who ran it was a guy named Willard P. Armstrong. He was a retired full bird colonel, I think, that started the organization. But, like, you could walk into this monthly meeting at any given time and see Dr. Hynek sitting there. I mean, it was just, it was like the meeting. And, you know, because MUFON and KUFOS, the big UFO organization, started in the Midwest anyway. And so those folks would come down to St. Louis and go to these meetings. It was like a thing. So when I was 13, I went and I joined that group. And I guess I was 17. I gave my first speech, which was on anti-gravity and propulsion, I mean, and detection methods for like building, you know, UFO detectors and stuff like that.
Cool.
That was a science teacher. So I was involved in the organization, but back in the day, like, MUFON was obviously a big organization. And by the way, that's the only other conference that's run longer than this one, is the MUFON International Conference. They were a little more selective back then. They really were, Walt was looking at the time for as many, like, you know, scientists and engineers and that he could get. He wasn't as concerned about, you know, 15-year-olds not knowing those kids. But I did get to go along and carry stuff for these guys, so it was interesting. Yeah, it was an interesting, and there was a lot going on in Missouri at the time. So I got to exposure to a lot of interesting people and experiences. And then I went away to college, and came back from college, got a job, got married, had kids. You know how it goes. Did not get right back involved in UFO activity, but kept reading and collecting books and trying to keep up on everything. And then in, I guess it was 1988, I decided, you know what, I need to get back involved in this thing. And so I started thinking about going back and rejoining the UFO Study Group of Greater St. Louis. And it actually took me about a year and a half before it happened, because I would go, okay, this month I'm going to the meeting. And then I'll go, oh, crap, it was last week. And I get the Sunday wrong. And then I wouldn't think about it for a few months. And then so finally, after about a year and a half of him and hawing about going, I looked up an old phone number and I called and I got the day. And I went in and I walked in, and here's a guy named Frank Brown. God love him. He's sitting at the table. He's probably the last face I saw when I went to one of the meetings, you know, 10 years or so ago. And he goes, I remember you. Your last time you were here, you were a kid, you know. And so I go, you have to join up again, you know. And I want to get involved. And so I was the only one there except for, like, him and a couple people that were, like, setting up the sound system. So I sat down, and I'm filling out the application, and one of the PA speakers is right in front of me. While I'm filling the application out, I'm very softly, this Moody Blues song starts coming out of the speaker, okay? And so I got there, I'm getting this little smile on my face, and I'm going, wow, these guys got this peg. You know, they're playing Moody Blues music, and they used to play, like, really cool, like, synthesizer music a long time ago. And I go, this is cool, they're playing Moody Blues music. And so I finish my application, and I go back up to Frank, and I go, here you go, Frank. And I go, hey, I'm really happy to hear that you guys are playing Moody Blues music before the meeting. And he goes, what? And I go, it's coming out of the speaker over there. And he listens, and he goes, oh, he says, we're not playing any music. He says, every once in a while, it just picks up a random radio station, and it plays through the speakers. Yeah. How do you explain that?
Yeah. Okay? And that's the one for you, Forrest.
It was nice and white set, and it started right at the very beginning of the song, and it went all the way through to the end, and then it cut out, and there was no more radio interference the whole rest of the meeting. Like, that's the kind of weird stuff that happens, okay?
So and it's just, like, a sign. It's just for you. It's a message to say, we're here. Are you getting it?
Well, I have to learn that over the years. I understand synchronicities are awesome. It's like the universe throwing you little breadcrumbs going, you're exactly where you're supposed to be right now.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So now I'm back on this path. The short version of the story is within a year, I had met Tom Stoltz, God rest his soul. He was the state director for Illinois MUFON at the time. I was downstate. He was in Chicago. So he, after we'd met a few times, he appointed me assistant state director for Illinois MUFON. And him and I worked together for a couple of years before he died. And then I became, because of that, the state director of Illinois MUFON, and held that position for 11 years. And one of the, so now if we get into the 90s, that's going to take a while. It's going to take weeks and weeks to tell all those stories because it's kind of one thing after another, and a lot of them were related to the Ozark Conference.
Mm-hmm.
The Ozark Conference was the first UFO conference that I'd ever been to, period, bar none. And it was the second one that I went to, so it was probably 1990. Or no, it might have been 89. I'm trying to pin down the time. Tom was down there, and him and I met this guy. And again, this is one of these things, we could talk about this case for hours. Somebody came up and grabbed us and said, hey, you got to meet this guy from Brazil. And, again, it's like when somebody says that at the Arkansas conference, you go with that, okay?
Yeah.
So we met this guy from Brazil, and the real short version of this story is the guy's parents had been killed by the Brazilian government. He fled the country and was staying with relatives here in the United States. Apparently, they had killed his parents. They were high-ranking government officials. They had killed him because of their involvement with some alien and UFO stuff. Turns out that this guy, and not only had a bunch of UFO experiences, but I know what I'm about to say is dropping a bombshell, okay? But I'm pretty convinced that he was a hybrid being, that he was half alien, half human. And I did not come to that conclusion lightly. He's one of the most bizarre, fascinating people that I'd ever met. And some of the strangest things I've ever experienced happened in this guy's presence with other people like Tom Stoltz and some of the other researchers from the Chicago group up there. We met this guy at the Arkansas conference, and we spent better part of, I guess, about a year and a half working with him, investigating his case and the phenomenon associated with him. And, I mean, I'm talking Moody Blue stuff, sure, but this is stuff like him doing a channeling session at Tom's house in Chicago and four or five aliens talking through him to us and answering questions. We could see the images of these aliens overlaid over his face. When he was done, had to cut his hair before and afterwards because he gets real dehydrated from the energy beam they use. I'm just reporting what mm-hmm, was said. Mm-hmm. Okay. He would have us touch his hair afterwards, and it was just like brittle and dry, and beforehand it was pretty oily, okay? And while we're touching this guy's hair, he goes, hey, by the way, you guys better, if you want to see their craft, you better rush outside. Now, we're in Downers Grove, Chicago, okay? So we all run outside, and we look up in the sky, and the constellation Orion was directly overhead and very prominent. And there was an extra star in the belt of Orion, okay? And after we, oh, look, that star, that's not supposed to be there. There's three stars in the belt of Orion, not four. And once we were all focused on it, then it streaked off and disappeared while we were looking at it. It was just a star-like object.
Cool.
But,
yeah.
I mean, this is, like I said, I could tell you stuff about this guy that would just, you know, it would just blow your mind, the stuff that that happened. And he walked into, came with his uncle to the Arkansas conference and ultimately got introduced to us. And it's everything about what happened with that guy, like, changed everything, you know, that I knew about the phenomenon and about what was going on. And
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So, wow. That's very cool. I'd like to talk to you more about that. We could do a whole other show about that, probably.
We can. I would be glad to, because there was some really, really strange stuff with this guy. I mean, really, really, like, split pupils, okay? Really strange stuff. Yeah, so, two heartbeats. very, very unusual stuff. So
very cool.
It's like, you know, it's all part of this journey of awakening to understanding what's going on, and again, this personal note that you talk about. There's so much of that out there, and I've known a bunch of researchers over the years. But some of them don't want to look at that. They don't want to talk about it. Maybe they think about it privately. But it really makes them nervous if you bring it up. Now others will, you know, we'll talk about it. Most people won't talk about it at the podium, but some will, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You cross a line if you go, I'm a researcher, and then you get up to the podium and go, guess what, I've had experiences. Okay, yeah. Some people don't want to cross that line.
But do you find, have you found that most, because see, like yourself, see, that's what got you to do that research. That's what pushed you. And I was going to say, that's why you were so compelled to do it, was because you had that experience. Would you say that is probably, and I don't want to put you on the spot and make you go out on a limb or anything, but to me, that would be a compelling thing. I mean, if you have an experience, that would be what drives you. To find out what it's all about, you know, and everything. Otherwise, it's like it's just out there. I mean, like, especially the ones that just keep going and going and going. It's like, what is it about it that keeps driving them other than they must have had something happen? That makes sense.
Right. It does. And it's also one of those things like, and I'm not, I don't want to put any particular researcher on the spot because everybody's on their own journey, you know. But if they're in denial about this, then I would question that. It's sort of like, well, you're not opening yourself up to fully understand all this if you don't fully understand your involvement in it, whatever that is. You know, you can't. This is one of the fallacies of pure science, anyway, is you really can't stand outside the universe and observe it without affecting it. And, you know, my original background when I went to college was in physics, and I still love it. I never did finish my degree in physics, but it's, you know, it's still a passion of mine. And it's, you know, science is observation and measurement. Well, that's pretty limited. And, you know, some modern scientists, and you know, especially some of these folks that are working with subatomic particles over at CERN, the super collider, they started to realize, and I even saw a documentary where they brought this up back in the 90s, where they're like, well, we realized that the attitudes and the thoughts of the scientists that were running the collisions could affect the outcome of the collisions. That steps outside pure. And so I really think that people who are driven to be involved in this phenomenon, myself included, is that there's a reason for that, we are playing a role, whether we understand it or remember it or not. And part of the journey, I think, at least it has been for me, is to go through and try and understand and remember.
Remember. Remember. I think that's the big word, is remember.
Right. Mm. Well, one of, I think, the most impactful books in recent times that are out on the subject that we're talking about right now is your mother's book, The Third Wave.
Yeah, The Three Waves of Volunteers.
Book,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I read that book. My skin tingled the whole time I read that book.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you remember, there's a few years back that Dolores gave a talk about that at the Arkansas conference. Mm-hmm. I never say in who was going to speak there. That wasn't, never was my role. But it was one of the, when I read that book, I started, I called Lou up and I said, I don't care what you do, this book has got to be talked about at this conference. And he got Dolores to come in and talk about that. It's one of those, like, you read that, it resonates with you, it wakes you up.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's another book, and I'll talk about this book because it also dovetails in what we're talking about with the music and the Moody Blues, is Ken Carey's book, Return of the Bird Tribes. That was one of those books for me. When I read that book, I had this, like, mind-blowing epiphany about, you know, myself. Yeah, a very personal epiphany. One of those experiences where, like, you're laughing and crying at the same time. It's like that kind of profundity. And in the afterword chapter of that book is the where the meat really is. And he talked about being at a meeting where he had a sweat lodge experience where he remembered being at a meeting before he was born here. And in that meeting, they were shown the nuclear explosions that were going on Earth with the testing in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The beings that were at this meeting were then asked to go and be part of a mission to Earth, to be born there. Some people would be off planet. Some people would be born on the planet. And the ones on the planet were going to forget who they were and why they were there. And that some of the people that were asked to be involved in this were going to deliver what they called trigger melodies.
Trigger noise?
Trigger melodies.
Melodies. So that, how cool. Oh, my gosh.
So that when you heard these melodies, it would awaken something in you that was, you know, pre-programmed in there, that if you heard this series of notes, that it would start jarring you awake and you would go down a path to remember who you were and why you were here.
Oh, my God.
And guess what? The Moody Blues are one of those musical groups that delivered the trigger melodies to wake people up, the first waivers. So you see how this all ties back together?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, you're telling that whole thing. My whole body was just vibrating. Oh, my gosh, this is so cool.
Yeah, because like I say, when I read Dolores' book, I'm like, holy crap, finally somebody is talking about this crossover point. Because I will tell you a personal experience. I have talked about this publicly. One of these days, I like I told you, I threatened to write all these stories down. But I started to the thought of writing a book a long time ago, actually. And this is a true story. It'll tell you everybody who's listening how weird I really am. When I was 2 years old, from the time that I was 2 until I was maybe 6, I had a recurring dream that it would happen early on, like, you know, let's say 2, 3, 4 years old. It would happen a couple times a month, and then it just kind of slowly stopped happening over time. So I haven't had this dream since I was maybe about 6. The dream was that I was floating in space, and below me was a craft. And I could see it. We were like traveling in unison through space. I was like, you know, mimicking the speed and the motion of this craft. And then when I thought about it, suddenly I'm inside the craft. So I'm standing inside and I'm looking around it. And there's a control panel over there with a guy sitting at the control panel flying the craft. And as I look at him and I think about it, and the next thing I know, boom, I'm him. I'm sitting at the controls. I'm flying this craft. Mm-hmm. And I can, even now telling this story, I can distinctly remember whenever I became him sitting at the counter, so I could feel the ship around me. Like I was touching a control that looked like a big, like, round trackball kind of thing. I was touching that, but I could feel the ship as if it was an extension of myself. And it could, and the ship knew what I was thinking. So all I had to do was think about where I wanted to go, and it would go there. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And outside the portal looms the earth. I'm flying up to the earth, and I go to this meeting. And in the meeting, we're asked to volunteer to go to Earth to help straighten shit out. I'm sorry, straighten stuff out.
No, it's okay. Yeah, that's what it is.
Sorry, and yeah, I apologize. I know better than do that on radio. And so I had at two years old, I would be, and I don't know, is the internet radio a little more lax on that? I don't know. So anyway, 2 years old, I remember telling my mom, now imagine being a mother. You got a 2 year old saying, Mom, I had that dream again. And she's like, what dream? And I go, you know, that dream about where I'm flying in space and that ship and I'm going to a meeting and we're going to come to Earth and help fix things. 2 year old. Okay.
Yeah.
So, that was across my mom's head there, having like, oh my God, what do I got? A 2 year old weird child here. Okay.
mm-hmm.
So I don't, you know, put this all together. Do I remember much more than that? Not really. But I mean, I've had some very, very interesting things. So when I read the Ken Carey book, when I read Dolores's book, it's this outside validation. I'm listening to the Moody Blues. When I was about seven, trying to think, when the Moody Blues first came out with Days of Future Past, it might have been 67 or 68. So I guess I was maybe 9-ish. I was a bowling brat. And my mom used to take me to the bowling alley with her. She would bowl. She'd give me a dollar. Now, back in the 60s, a dollar is a fortune to a kid. Okay? She'd give me a dollar, probably out of some guilt that she was bowling while I was running around the bowling alley with the other bowling brats. And it was, you know, to buy hot dogs and popcorn and play games, whatever. I would go into the deli at the cafe part of the bowling alley. And if you're old enough, you remember the little flip jukeboxes that were at each of the booths, like the old diner.
Yeah.
Okay. I would go, I would take, and I would get my dollar changed into dimes because that's how much music cost back then. And I would go to one of those little jukebox boxes. And I would put all 10 dimes in there, and I would play Nights in White Satin 10 times in a row. My friends looked at me like, what in the heck is wrong with you? You got a dollar? My mom gave me a quarter, you know, and you're not even going to, like, buy food with that? Are you at least going to sit here and listen to the song? And I would go, no, I don't even know what group that is. I didn't even own a radio at the time. I didn't know what the Moody Blues were.
Wow.
And all my money playing Nights in White Satin over and over again. Okay.
Huh.
So you talk about discovering, you know, you piece all this together, you discover your journey, whatever the hell that means. I must have been doing something interesting before I was born here.
Wow. Okay. Well, we're almost out of time for us. So I want to, real quick, if anyone wants to connect with you, do you have a way for them to do that? I know I'm catching you off guard with that because that's not normally your thing to be public out there with things. But, I mean, just in case you do, do you have any way that you want, you know, do you have anything like that? Do you want to put out?
I don't mind giving my email address so that people can email me. It's Blue Feather Forest. So BLUEFEATHERFOREST @gmail.com.
Okay. Okay. And then I just want to remind everybody real quick, the conference will be April 14th to the 16th. And the website, if you want to find out more about it, is www.OzarkUFOConference.com. And I think we're going to be out of time just really quick here. But Forrest, thank you so much. And I'm definitely going to have you back because you have so much to talk about. And I want to talk to you about putting your things down into a book because you have such fascinating material. You do need to put it down. So Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone. And we'll see you next week. And good night.